Guiding children is hard. And if you want to learn how to guide children in a healthy and effective way, go get my online course. There's life-changing information that is also engaging to watch. It is conveniently linked in the show notes just for you.
And this gets mixed up very often, but neurodiversity is referring really to the same way that cultural diversity or like biodiversity refers just to kind of the infinite variations that can exist in the world. So neurodiversity is actually everybody. Everybody together creates neurodiversity. Neurodivergence is when a person's like way of processing the world and taking in information and their behaviors is atypical.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today I have a great episode that was sparked off of the Instagram post that has sparked a lot of conversation. And I thought instead of making some posts or doing some stories about it, that we just dive deep into it in a podcast conversation. Without further ado, I will let the guest introduce herself and then we will get started with the conversation. Go ahead.
Hi, I am Katie Higgins Lee, and I am a neurodivergent therapist and parent. And I also supervise fellow therapists and train fellow therapists. And I am in Northern California. And then I also do a lot of advocacy on social media related to neurodiversity. And I am, some of you might know me online as Tending Paths.
Tending Paths. Mm-hmm. So, oh yeah, and there was that actually, you saying your name actually reminded me of another question that I'm going to have to bring up, because you were talking about tending the nervous system as opposed to regulating it. And so we're going to put a pin on that for a moment, a little teaser for you. But first, let's talk about the Venn diagram that you created and put out there. I saw that it's been updated many times. And let's go ahead and tell us a little bit. Why did you create the Venn diagram? What was it about? What would you add to it if you were to update it again? Tell us about that Venn diagram that got so many people talking and just thinking.
Sure. Yeah. So I feel like to explain why I created it, I would have to go back a little bit to kind of explain a little bit of my story of how I got there.
Please do.
If that's all right. Okay. Yeah. So I was identified as gifted when I was, I think, about 7. And was very lucky that I ended up actually being in, for me, it was lucky. I know this isn't the right choice for everyone, but I was put into a full-time gifted class for 3 years, which was a wonderful experience for me. I know that's not always the case, but for me that was. And then fast forward to when I was 40 or 41, I had been a therapist for over 10 years at that point. I had 2 kids, and I started to notice a lot of traits in my kids. And so I started looking into giftedness again, because I hadn't really thought about it for years. But then I was seeing some things in my kids, and other people would comment about traits in my kids that were just atypical. And so I thought, okay, maybe this is giftedness. So I started looking into it a bunch more, and I did trainings on working with gifted clients also. And then in that, somebody that was training me in working with giftedness asked me if I'd considered that I could be autistic. And I initially was like, no way. What are you talking about? That doesn't make any sense. And then I did a bunch of research, and started to, it took me quite a while to come to this. There was a lot of, acceptance that had to come with this, of recognizing that it actually did fit for me. And I decided to pursue an official assessment. And they said, yes, you're absolutely autistic. They said, it's not even a close call with you, which was surprising to me also. And they said, and we think that you have ADHD, which was another big shock for me. So that kind of caused me to dive into just a huge just, you know, researching and trying to learn more and understand, partially because there's a belief that's talked about a lot in the giftedness community. There's this belief that a lot of people that are gifted get misdiagnosed as autistic or ADHDers. And that belief is something that I read about. And so that actually delayed me getting a correct diagnosis for myself and actually for my kids as well, because they ultimately have also gotten diagnosed with various things. So that belief in the giftedness community kind of delayed my understanding. And then as I went into learning more about neurodiversity and started getting trained in neurodiversity affirming practices and learning about my family and learning about me, I saw that within the neurodiversity affirming community, there was this belief that giftedness isn't real at all. That they think that many people, not everyone, but many people think that giftedness is actually missed diagnosis of autism or ADHD. So there's these two like opposite beliefs. The giftedness community think that they also believe that there's not really any overlap between autism and ADHD and giftedness. And then the neurodiversity community thinks the opposite of that. And so I started to see this, and I was sort of in between these two worlds and was feeling frustrated with this lack of understanding. That what my belief was after all of this research and based on my own experience was that there is tons of overlap, but that they are separate. There are many people in the world that are just autistic or just gifted, and then many people that are both, and then also ADHD as well. Just like with autism and ADHD, they're not the same thing, but there's a lot of overlap that many people are both. So the creating of this diagram was partially trying to put down on paper something that was in my mind, basically, that it helps me to visualize things. So I wanted to make it a visual representation to help myself. But then also there are a lot of Facebook groups for therapists. And in one particular group, there was an argument that happened amongst therapists, which can get surprisingly vicious, which is pretty horrible. But it was about this, basically, that there were people that were saying both sides of this. And so I wanted to show the fact that there is overlap and sort of differentiate between what's what. And so I decided to create this Venn diagram. I didn't expect that it would get as much attention as it did. I actually created it a year ago in August of last year. And then because of social media algorithms or whatever, it showed up again a year later. That it started to show up again. And so it's been kind of making the rounds again in the last few weeks. And I guess I didn't, you know, ever describe that it's a Venn diagram that compares these three neurotypes, as I refer to them. So giftedness, autism, and ADHD, and shows how they have some traits. Each of them have traits that are distinct to each of them, but that there are many, many overlaps between them.
I'm actually going to back up even further. You just ask you, what is neurodiversity? What can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I've also been seeing more conversation about just really asking that question, what is it? And what fits into what's neurodivergent and what doesn't fit into it? And so could you share what it is and what you think in your perspective?
Sure. So, and this gets mixed up very often, but neurodiversity is referring really to the same way that cultural diversity or like biodiversity refers just to kind of the infinite variations that can exist in the world. So neurodiversity is actually everybody. Everybody together creates neurodiversity. Neurodivergence is when a person's like way of processing the world and taking in information and their behaviors is atypical. So I often think of it like a path. That metaphor is very big for me, which is why path, that word is in my social media name. But basically I think of it like there is one main path that most people are on in terms of kind of their way of processing things. And then there are these branches that come off of that path. And some people branch off just a little, you know, little bit. They're kind of going right next to the main path. And then some people go even further off. And then some of us that are multiply neurodivergent, like neurodivergent in multiple ways, go even kind of further off of that path. So neurodivergence is just this idea of certain people having less typical ways of processing the world. And so that can include innate neurodivergence. So that would be things that you are born with. Despite some of the misinformation out there, autism is genetic. It's not something that we get. It's not a disease that we like catch or something. It is innate, just as ADHD is also innate. It's something that we're born with. And then giftedness also is something that, you know, some people are just born with slightly different ways of processing. Dyslexia is another example of innate neurodivergence. And then there is acquired neurodivergence. So really, anything that is in the DSM, so the DSM is the you know, the manual for diagnosing mental disorders, but also like neurodevelopmental disorders. And so anything in the DSM would be considered neurodivergence. So really, depression, you know, when it's clinical, like, you know, major depression, anxiety, OCD, personality disorders, all of that is neurodivergence. Even things like TBIs, like traumatic brain injuries, that would also be an example of an acquired neurodivergence. And most acquired neurodivergences, in my opinion, many of them are trauma, like they're related to trauma in some way. Some people would disagree on that, but that's my belief, that most acquired neurodivergences are related to trauma. Sometimes it's the combination of like somebody who has an innate neurodivergence, like say ADHD, and then there's a poor fit in their environment. And then that leads to trauma, which then leads to another kind of acquired neurodivergence.
Okay, but so playing devil's advocate a little bit here, why does that all matter? Like, why does it even matter? Why do we have to have labels? Why can't people just be people? Yeah, sure, people think differently, but why do we have to label ADHD or autistic or gifted, or why even put these labels on people?
Yeah, that is it's such a great question. And it comes up so often. I've had so many conversations about this. So the way that I look at it, so I'm also a gardener. That's one of the things that I love to do. And so when caring for plants, it's really helpful to know what kind of plant it is, right? Mm. It's helpful to know not just the name of that individual plant, but what category it fits in. Like if somebody gives me a present and it's a succulent, it's helpful to know it's a succulent because that has very different watering needs. It also has different needs in terms of most succulents can't be in freezing weather without dying. They need to be in slightly warmer weather. So some people will say, okay, well, why can't we just look at each individual plant and figure it out? It's a lot more difficult to figure it out by having to like do trial and error with each one when we can have these labels, these categories that can help us know what are the most likely needs of that particular person based on what category that they fit in. And, you know, one thing that I like to mention too, is that the beginning of my career as a therapist, I was really anti-label. Like I thought that the DSM was just this, you know, like tool that was not really very, I mean, I knew it was useful in terms of we needed to have diagnoses because that's how insurance is willing to pay for things. But a lot of it to me, like I said, just, it seemed like it was all just trauma. And so I didn't think that these individual labels were that useful, even though I had to use them because I work within the medical system. And then it was again, that was part of that journey for me, was recognizing that these labels are not just helpful, but for some people essential, to being able to understand how the people in their life, like what their needs are and then what our own needs are. And that's one of the things also is, you know, I really prefer to define these neurotypes by what our needs are as opposed to traits that you can observe, because traits that you can observe, you don't know what the need behind that is necessarily. Yeah. And that's what really needs to be addressed in order to make accommodations and support for everyone.
Yeah. You can't really do anything with that. Like, yes, you can observe the behavior, but most people don't know what to do with the behavior. So you're just looking at it and you're just often judging it without really being able to put yourself in a place to be helpful for this person who often is calling, crying, you know, trying to, in their own way, communicate, calling for help. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. The categories, the groups are really helpful for us to have a starting off point to start to help and support people. And you say you like to kind of identify people or identify people's needs really first. So what would you say for, help us out there, people for ADHD, autistic, giftedness, what are these kind of different needs that these different categories have? Because a lot of people out there do have either maybe they suspect that they themselves are autistic, ADHD, or gifted, or maybe they have a child who they know or suspect is. So help us out here.
Sure. Okay. So let's start with ADHD. So with, and every person is different, of course, right? And that's important to remember. But some patterns that I have seen for sure, and that I've, you know, read about in research, ADHD, there is a need for novelty. So like newness, for things to not just be the same and monotonous every day. So novelty, there's a need for creative expression. That seems really important to have like some sort of creative outlet. And then physical movement is really, really important for most people that are ADHDers. So those are the big ones, I would say, for ADHD. There's, you know, there's more, but those are the basic ones.
Yeah.
And then there's also, yeah, again, I don't think I can go into every detail because there's so many, but
yeah,
there's more in terms of like, you know, like depending on the environment, like in school environments or work environments, there would be different needs specifically for each of these.
Yeah.
So then for autism, a lot of the needs are related to sensory information and sensory processing. And one thing that's important to know with when we talk about senses and the sensory systems, and this is, you know, this is not my area of expertise. I just want to give that disclaimer, because really talking about sensory systems is really more in the realm of like what OTs, occupational therapists, work with. But I've, you know, I've learned about it enough to talk about it a little bit. So there are 8 sensory systems as opposed to the 5 that are more known about. The 5 main ones, you know, sight, seeing, all of those are related to taking in information from the outside. But then there's these other 3 sensory systems that relate to information from inside the body. So vestibular is balance, and proprioception is related to like muscles and joints. And then interoception is the sense of internal body states, as in it could be like being hungry, being tired, needing to pee, but it can also be knowing that you're happy or sad or excited, being able to recognize, like identify those and recognize what they are and then meet whatever that need is. So basically people that are autistic tend to have hyper and hyposensitivity in these areas. So one person could be hypersensitive and hyposensitive in different areas. And so because of that, there is a sort of chaos to our internal experience. Everyone can experience chaos in certain situations if things are really intense, but for people that are autistic, it tends to happen like we have a lower threshold, basically, so it happens faster. So things that somebody that's not autistic to them would feel like no big deal, to an autistic person can sometimes be really, really intense. An example of that is like when I was a child, I had a really hard time with socks. This is a really common one, not just with people that are autistic, but I could not find socks that were comfortable to me. And it was very distressing, very distracting. would wear my socks inside out. I would, you know, wear like other things to avoid wearing socks because it was so distressing for me. And again, that's just one example. And just having a sock sensitivity does not mean that you're autistic automatically, but that's just, that's one example. When the sensitivities are in multiple areas, that's where it becomes more likely that a person is autistic. So our needs involve basically having either the ability to avoid certain sensory sensations, like so to not be forced to eat certain foods that are overwhelming for us on a sensory level. So avoiding things, but also sensory seeking. So that's where if we are hyposensitive to a certain sensory system, then we might seek out sensory stimulation. So like an example of that is like chewing. One of my kids will like chew on his shirt, so the collar of his shirt, at an age that most, you know, non-autistic kids would not be doing that anymore. Because yeah, I know, you know, younger kids, pretty much all of them put everything in their mouth. But once you reach a certain age, it's less common. Yeah. And that is meeting a sensory need for, from my understanding, proprioceptive input actually that you get from chewing on things. So another need in terms of autism is directness. So needing direct communication. And some people that involves like needing there to not be, well, like metaphor, like I used the metaphor earlier about gardens. Some autistic people might have a hard time with that because, you know, it's not as direct. For me personally, it's more that if somebody is talking to me and they are not directly saying exactly what they mean, like if they're sort of talking around it, trying to be very gentle and talking around something, I get really confused. Like, wait, what are you saying? I'm not clear on what you're trying to tell me right now. So again, that's just another example. I could go on and on for those, but those are just a couple of examples. And then for giftedness, there is a need for complexity. There's a need for intellectual stimulation. There's a need to connect with, well, and this is actually true for, this is where it gets complicated because there's overlap, but there's a need for, like to connect with other people through, complexity, like through, like talking about theory, things like that can be part of giftedness. Autism also, there's a need to connect with people through interests. And with ADHD, there is as well. Like they talk about all three of these as being interest, as having interest-based nervous systems. Like we, with all three neurotypes, there's a need to, be able to have our interests and the things that we are really into be part of our connections with other people. So that could be video games, it could be books, it could be like fandoms of various kinds, it could be, you know, like I mentioned, plants, like it can be anything, but all three of these, there is a need for that, but in slightly different ways.
So would you, this is one thing that is in each circle of the Venn diagram, interest-based activities, connecting with others through your interests, right? And so regardless of, you know, and I would say that this would be something that's would be valuable for someone who's not neurodivergent, someone in like.
Yeah absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and so like, and I think about like, you know, pieces of advice to give parents. And I think that would probably sounds like would be very helpful for most kids and most people. Is to really pay attention to what they're interested in. And if there is, like, you know, by the time that usually when they start 5 and 8, there starts to be like more clubs or like community, like groups and stuff like that, that you can do and you can put your kids into. Would that be something you would probably try to recommend for most kids, or you would recommend for parents to do? Did you have anything like that growing up? I know you said that you were in the gifted program. Was there anything else other than that, that you were able to connect through interest?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it was theater, that I found theater and singing and dancing. And that was kind of, I think, how I got through like junior high and high school was through my theater community. It was like community theater that we had in our town. And that I think actually was a big part of why, even though I'm autistic and an ADHDer and gifted, which all three of those can sometimes have difficulties socially. And I didn't have as many issues because I had my theater community, and so many people that are in theater honestly are neurodivergent in some way.
Yeah.
And so I had my people, like I was fine. You know, they're not to say that I haven't struggled in certain ways socially, but that made a huge difference for me that I had an interest that was somewhat socially acceptable, depending on who you're talking to. But in general, it was socially acceptable, and it was a big group of people. So it was a community. And so I felt very, you know, held by that. But in terms of parents in general, yeah, I think for most kids, having opportunities to pursue their interests, I think, is so important through, like you said, like clubs and groups and things like that. But also to have whoever the caregivers are, whoever the parents are, for them to show an interest, even if it's something that's not interesting to you, to at least try to recognize that there is value in their interest, even if it's not something that you value yourself. So for me, an example of this is video games. I am like honestly sort of impaired when it comes to playing video games. Mm-hmm. I have like spatial awareness issues. So I can do like side scroller games, but anything that's like, you know, within the last 20 years where there's like more than one dimension, I have a really hard time with. But I have a family of gamers. And so I make a point of trying to connect with them through video games, even if it's just watching them play or watching videos of other people play or talking to them about video games, reading books about the video games with them. Like that goes a really long way in terms of connecting with them. And video games, I know there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people have, there's just a lot of different opinions about video games and whether or not they are damaging or not. I personally believe that they can be very, very helpful for most people, for most kids and adults, because they are an example of storytelling. And a big part of what for me has always been sort of, it's like a theme throughout my life, has been an interest in things that are related to storytelling. Like I did theater, and then my undergrad degree is actually in film studies. And then I became a therapist, got my master's in counseling. And that to me is also about stories. It's about learning people's stories and understanding people's stories. And like the hero's journey, I think, is a really important process to understand. And video games can be an opportunity to support kids in understanding a lot of like social emotional things through a story that they're already interested in. And so whatever, so my point, I know it's a tangent, but my point is just whatever your children are interested in, to find the value in that instead of having this expectation that they should be interested in something else.
And, you know, the storytelling you said has been kind of a connection in throughout your life. But I would say that throughout humanity, like storytelling has been a thing, right? And I mean, you know, kids might be on their video games, but like us adults, we're all binging shows on Netflix all the time, or the other 5, 6, 7, 8 streaming services that we own, right?
Yep, exactly. You know,
and then when we come off of work, we're venting, or we're talking to our partner or someone we trust, we're telling them the story about what happened with some challenge or some struggle. So, you know, I think storytelling can be is a powerful thread just for humans in general, and something that we can definitely take advantage of if we can use it intentionally. I'm sure, and I don't know what your opinion, we don't have to have this whole conversation about video games, but it would be interesting to have a conversation. You know, I think just like with TV, I think there's probably different quality of video games that people play that will have their different maybe pros and cons and whatever.
Right. Yeah. They meet different needs depending on what the game is too, I think is part of it, you know, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Meet different needs. I think that's a really good way to put it. So this is kind of I'm going to make it a segue into what I want to talk about. You know, the video games, I think a lot of people are concerned sometimes concerned of what the, I don't know, the high speed action and all the hits of dopamine can do to our nervous system. And just a lot of people report that, you know, when my children play video games or they're on video games, that they tend to be more dysregulated maybe throughout the day. And you had a really interesting video that you were talking about how you don't look at it as regulating the nervous system. And that's the language that I use, talk about regulating, you know, self-regulation, regulating your nervous system. But you had a little bit of a different take on it. And I thought it was really interesting. I would love for you to kind of share your perspective on nervous systems and regulating them.
Yeah, definitely. So so the video that you're referencing is, and I talk about this in a number of different posts that I've done, but that one video, yes, I talk about the idea of just a different languaging that I prefer to use, of saying tending the nervous system instead of regulating the nervous system. That for me personally, it's helpful to reframe it as tending, because tending, that word means like to watch over, care for, provide like protection and nourishment. And I think of really everything I do is tending. I mean, this is a slight tangent, but just as a therapist, I'm tending my clients and helping my clients learn to tend for themselves. I'm tending to my children and helping them learn to tend for themselves. I tend to myself as well. I also tend a garden. I have a cat. I help tend to the cat. Like I prefer that word because it's very helpful for me. And then in terms of nervous system, to tend to the nervous system for me is the idea of, instead of regulating, where that implies controlling, like it implies mm-hmm. this idea that it's your nervous system needs to be in a certain state. Instead, tending is to notice this person that's in front of you and notice where their nervous system is right now and notice what do they need, as opposed to very often regulating is related to the environment. Like, we need you to be this certain way. We need your nervous system to be in this certain state because you're at school right now, or because it's bedtime, or because it's dinner time. And that implies control. And that to me just doesn't work. And so I prefer to think mm-hmm. of it as tending. And also part of that is because, again, looking at different needs, that if somebody, again, has sensory seeking behaviors, they are seeking stimulation in order to tend to their nervous system. So for some people, that video game that's fast paced and you know, has all this action and bright lights, that's what they need to actually tend to their nervous system. So, like, you know, for example, my kids, my kids, when they play the video games that they enjoy, they will afterwards be in a much better mood than if they haven't gotten to play. But that is very different from when my kids watch television, they have a very hard time. It doesn't work for them. And that's not true of everyone. Like, I had a conversation with a friend one time where his children, it's the opposite, that video games cause them to have a really hard time, but TV works just fine for them. And that's where I think figuring out for each child what they actually need can be helpful, and to help them understand it. Especially with my older child who's 9, he's able to really now most of the time tell us, like, oh, I don't want to watch that movie today. That's not going to be it. Like, he doesn't say it in the words like this, but it's basically him telling us that it's not what his nervous system needs on that day. I mean, he doesn't say it like that, but it's clear that he knows, like, no, that wouldn't be good for me today. And then other days it is. You know, and on certain days he needs to go on a rope swing instead of playing that video game, or maybe he needs both, but like figuring out what each person needs, and it will vary from day to day, and to have conversations and helping our children and helping ourselves also recognize what are the things that help us meet our, again, a lot of it is sensory needs, but also our nervous system needs.
You know what? I gotta say, I think tending does feel a little bit more accurate to me than when I think about the word regulate, because it's like regulate just feels so abrupt. And like it's just this one singular moment and event. And in my experience, that it's like it's more of an ongoing practice that tending seems to describe a lot more accurately, right? Like in a classroom, I feel more that I'm tending to all the nervous systems in the classroom rather than doing something like quickly or abruptly to just like completely change their nervous system, like almost in an instant. It's almost this ongoing practice of just like, of what I'm putting in the room, of the emotional climate and the tone in the room and how I'm responding or encouraging or giving someone a job. And like all these things are like little moments to tend to their nervous systems. And it doesn't, you know, one singular thing doesn't necessarily completely change their state, but it's more kind of moves along and more. And I also really relate to almost like the planting seeds kind of connotation of tending, right? Of where it's like what you're doing right now you may not see a huge abrupt change in that child's nervous system in that moment, but over time, as you continue to do things, you can see a lot of growth and you see the fruit that it bears. And so I really liked when I heard you use that and you were talking about it and I was reflecting on my own experiences, tending really did feel right for me. So I appreciate you putting that out there into the world and I feel grateful for being able to find it and consume it and continue to think about all that. So I want to say thank you for that.
That's great. Thank you for saying that. And I love the way that you just described that experience in a classroom setting too, because that's exactly it. Like, like when I fertilize a plant, I am not going to see this immediate change in it. It takes some time and there needs to be like ongoing paying attention to what it needs, you know?
And the ongoing paying attention too, like, and I'm even thinking about for like myself and like thinking about your own nervous and like what I need, like that is, it still feels more accurate. Like, you know, today when I woke up, like it was more, you know, it's certain things I'm doing where I'm eating a certain food or I am exercising and it's not like this, you know, just eating or just exercising. Like if I just exercise and I don't eat, then that throws it off. If I eat and don't exercise, then I'll feel a little different. And it's just, and some days I really just can't exercise. I really just don't have it in me. And I recognize it would be better for me to just lay in bed for a little bit long, for that 30 minutes to 45 minutes that I was going to go work out. This is the process of tending to our own nervous systems and tending to other people's nervous systems, people that we're caring for. Can I ask, I'm actually going to shift gears, because I wanted to ask this earlier. And I'm ADHD. I don't know if I mentioned that or said it out loud, but I'm ADHD. And so even when you were talking about like, novelty and exercise. And there's one other thing that you said,
creativity.
It's like, that's like my daily routine. It's like, that's what I have to do to tend to my nervous system. And even from a young age, I recognized that going to school did not feel like it was tending to my nervous system. The process of school did not feel like it was tending to my nervous system. And it helped me realize and recognize that I needed to find something that I enjoyed. I could use my creativity, something that I can enjoy. I played soccer for a really long time. And so, I don't know, I'm just even thinking about like how helpful recognizing those needs are.
Yeah.
Or what you decide to do in like little decisions, but also the big decisions too, I think is really valuable. What are your thoughts in terms of how the education system, how these different neurotypes fit into the education system that is largely factory model? I know you said you had a good experience with the gifted program, and you're also acknowledging that everyone has that experience. Like, what's your...
Yeah. And that's making me realize that also during my introduction, I don't think mention something that's an important part of me is that we homeschool our kids. And that's because I did not have plans to homeschool. Like I am, you know, I'm definitely like, you know, a supporter of, you know, the public education system. But once I met my older child and got to know him, it was very clear that at least where we live, especially because there aren't a ton of options where I live, that there wasn't really anything that would have met his needs. And that, you know, like what you just said about your experience with school and recognizing that going to school wasn't helpful in tending your nervous system, it's very clear that that would be the case. And, you know, initially it was with my older child and then eventually with my younger one also, because we also thought, okay, well, we'll homeschool our older one. And then the younger one, he might want to go to school. But once we got to know him too, it was like, no, he would not fit in a traditional education system. We don't have a lot of alternative options here. So we homeschool, and then we ended up now we've shifted to unschooling, like self-directed education, where they get to choose what they learn, which you might think that they don't want to learn anything. For us right now, one of them, there's a lot he wants to learn about. And the other one, he doesn't want to do anything kind of more formally, but he asks questions every single day that are very complex that we, you know, we just answer the questions and we'll find resources to give him the information about what he wants to know about. But in terms of more like broadly neurodivergence and education, I think it really, really depends. Each individual is so different. Because even, you know, some autistic kids will do really well in school. They do great with the routine of it. Other autistic kids will have just a very hard time in school. So it just really, really depends. And it also depends on what resources there are and what kinds of school environments there are. Because there's certain like methodologies for education that I think are going to be more difficult for somebody that's neurodivergent, and then other ones that would be more helpful. And so, yeah. I mean, I know that might not be that helpful, but it basically just saying it really, really depends. I will say one thing though, for sure, that, and we didn't talk about this yet, but I think it's important to mention that there is I'm not sure if you're familiar with PDA, which stands for pathological demand avoidance. Some people have reframed it as, I think it's pervasive drive for autonomy. And it's a proposed subtype of autism. And many, many children that are diagnosed as ODD, as oppositional defiant disorder, are actually PDA. Because PDA, it's a very different presentation of autism. Many kids that are PDA, they have a missed diagnosis of autism and PDA. PDA is not official. It's not an official diagnosis yet here. I actually don't know if it's official anywhere yet, but it's at least a little more known in certain places, like I think in the UK. But it is gaining sort of awareness everywhere at this point. And so for kids that are PDA, the traditional school system is really, really, really difficult. Like I honestly don't know of many kids that are PDA that can do well in a school system. Because they need to have so much autonomy, and that is really a need that they have. It's related to the way that their nervous system operates, that they need to have a lot of autonomy over what they get to do. And the school system, I mean, it's in most situations kind of impossible for a teacher to have that many children in a classroom and to be able to meet the needs of a PDA child. So for many, many people that have PDA kids end up going the route that we have, which is unschooling or self-directed education. And there's some really great books out about, I'm not going to remember the name of the book right now. A Different Way to Learn, I think it's called, and I'm not remembering the author's name right now, is a really great book about this. And then Low Demand Parenting by Amanda Diekman is another really great book for anyone that's kind of wondering about this sort of way of relating to kids, and especially PDAers.
Well, thank you for those resources. Mm-hmm. I'm going to wrap it up, and I want you to kind of share anything else you want to just share with the world, or like some kind of just anything else you want to say to the audience, some helpful tips, anything that, any resources, please share. And we're going to kind of wrap it up there.
Okay. Okay. So let me think of what I want to share. So there's four things that I think are really important for, really for anyone who has neurodivergent kids. And those things are, one, to explore and identify your own neurodivergence as a parent, if that fits. Again, these innate kinds of neurodivergence are genetic. And so if you have a child that's neurodivergent, it's really likely that you or the other parent are, if you're the biological parents of this child, it's very, very likely. So to explore that, and to, again, identify, the specific kinds of neurodivergence of your kids. Number two is to understand sensory needs, and to support your own and the rest of your family's sensory needs is really important. Third is to understand the nervous system and how it relates to behavior. I know that you had an episode, or maybe a couple episodes, with Mona Delahook, who talks a lot about that. And, she's a great resource for that, her books. And then also the last one is just to, kind of shift our expectations of kids, because there's and of ourselves. That one I think is so important, just to recognize, where did we get these expectations? Like, where did we form these expectations that we have? Because very often expectations are based on like neuronormative ideas, and also like heteronormative ideas, and also like patriarchal and colonialist ideas about what we should be doing as people and what our kids should be doing. And so just to examine those a little bit and to rethink them, I think is really important. I could talk about that for a long time, but I just wanted to mention it.
I might have you talk about that for a little bit longer, but yeah, go ahead and say your fourth one.
Okay. That was the fourth one though. Those are the four things. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you to talk about that one a little bit longer. How do you shift that expectation? Because a lot of parents' concerns would be like, am I enabling them, or am I just letting them run all over me or do whatever they want? And so they're going to grow up and be adults who think they can do whatever they want and hurt people or whatever. And so like, can you maybe speak a little bit to maybe that concern, but also what's that process of maybe rethinking some of our expectations?
I think learning more about the nervous system is one way, because that so often when we can understand our children's behaviors through the nervous system, that can really shift our expectations of them, because very often we're putting expectations on them that are not realistic for what's happening with their nervous system, and what their needs are. So I think understanding the nervous system for me is like just so, so important. Again, that Low Demand Parenting book, I think, is really, really helpful. It's a short book, which I appreciate as an ADHD person. I appreciate that. She does a really wonderful job of explaining. She doesn't use that exact languaging that I just used, but, just explaining like all of the demands that we put on people based on ideas that we have of what they should be doing, and really looking at like, is that actually something that has to happen? Like, I'm pretty sure one of the examples in the book is, do they have to eat their breakfast at the table at a certain time of day? Or could they eat their breakfast in their bedroom so that they can tend to their nervous system before they have to go engage with the rest of the family? Like things like that, where we have this idea that people need to do a certain thing. The way that children interact with adults is another one. Like, why do we have these expectations that children are supposed to interact with adults in this very specific way, and that they're supposed to talk to them in a certain way and make eye contact and answer the questions. And again, it's a lot of demands that are put on children when they're their own little people, you know, like they have their own needs. The other one in terms of like expectations of ourselves as adults is the resource is, I'm pretty sure that you had her on your podcast also. Casey Davis, what's the name of her book? How to Keep Pets While Drowning.
Yeah.
That book I think is really great also at just looking at like, you know, the expectations that we put on ourselves, especially as parents. But I think that book is helpful for anyone who's not a parent as well. At, you know, what, why do we have to do things a certain way?
Yeah.
You know, like the way that we keep our house, the way that we do our laundry, the way that we brush our teeth, like all of these various things that we think we're supposed to do them a certain way that is sort of like normal. But most of those things are not actually normal. And again, they're based on like one particular demographic. Like there, a lot of them in our society are so based on a, well, like people who are more neuronormative or neurotypical, white, wealthy, like there's all these like ideas that we have that that's the ideal, but like, no, that's not necessarily the ideal. It's definitely not the ideal. That's just one way of being. And there's just so much variety in terms of what our individual needs are.
Yes. Oh, great. Thank you so much, Katie. And Katie does trainings for therapists.
Oh yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. Yes. I forgot I was going to mention that. Yes. I work with adult clients and teenagers. So I do trainings for therapists on working with neurodiversity. Most often it's been related to either autism, ADHD, or giftedness, because those are the things that I know the most about. Those are the things that I also, most of my clients fit into those categories as well. And one of the, I'm just going to mention this, one of the sort of like tenets of the neurodiversity movement, and this is also from the disability rights movement, is nothing about us without us. So the idea is like, I'm not going to do a training on, I'm trying to think of an example, like panic disorder, because that's not my lived experience. And even if I might do a ton of trainings and learn about it, it's not, I don't think that I have the right to do a training on that. And so that's why I specifically focus on the neurotypes that are my lived experience.
Great.
And if, in terms of that, the trainings that I do for therapists, if anyone's interested, my social media on Instagram and Facebook is Tending Paths. And on my link tree, there's a link to be added to my mailing list to find out about trainings.
What's my name? What's my name?